Our guest speaker for today are Mark Pesci. Mark Pesci is an honorary associate of the Digital Cultures Program, and every year he test drives one of his keynote talks to various conferences on My Cyberworlds Group. This year his talk is Better Than Crack. Mark will be explaining a lot more what that's all about. Mark is the only person I know whose job description is futurist. He makes regular appearances on the new Inventors program, some of you may have seen on ABC, and sort of regularly writes for mainstream media and gives conference presentations. Mark?
Thank you. None of that out of you. Okay, so we're going to go on a journey through space and time today. And when we do that, I have to start off with a little story. I'm actually going to tell a whole bunch of stories, but I have to start off with a little story by the title of Mother Modernhood. Now, you know Broadway, it's a big road, goes down to Central Station, and beginning of March, I was walking home from the doctor's, because I don't own a car, I was walking home down Broadway, heading towards Central Station, and I came to the intersection with Abercrombie Street. You're probably all familiar with it. It's a very busy intersection. And I'm standing at the intersection, facing the other side, looking at the pedestrians queued up across the intersection at the other side, and in front of all the pedestrians queued up is a mother with a baby in a pram. It wasn't really a baby. It was like an 18-month-old in the pram. And she's sitting there, and she's waiting for the light to turn so that she can cross the intersection. I'm waiting for the light to turn so that I can cross the intersection, and the lights turn, and we start to cross the intersection. And she takes the pram, and she pushes it across the curb, and she nearly dumps her 18-month-old into the intersection. And in fact, if the 18-month-old hadn't been securely fastened in, she would have dumped the child into Abercrombie Street. So she goes, okay, that didn't work. She backs up. And she makes another attempt, and she nearly does it again. The reason she nearly does it is because at no point in this process did she take her goddamned iPhone away from her ear. So she was doing the entire thing. And when you have a pram and you only have one hand, you're not going to have the kind of leverage you need. And it never occurred to her to take the phone away from her ear. Now, we are going to circle back to that story, but that story that I've just told you contains everything that you need to know about this lecture today. And we found now something that is so compelling that it is starting to override a basic evolutionary drive, which is take care of your children. Okay? The mothering instinct is basic. It is essential. It's part of the firmware. You can't really run away from it. And yet, somehow, when you get this close enough to your ear, you kind of forget that you have your 18-month-old hanging out right there beneath you. And we see this all the time. We see this behavior that starts to override common sense. I actually walk around a lot and text. And of course, when you do that, you have a tendency to walk into people, walk over curbs, trip over things. You probably all do that as you're walking around campus with hilarious results. We all do that. And of course, there's lots of examples of people. And how many of you, now come on, be honest, how many of you have texted while driving? Yes, I've done exactly the same thing. And I don't own a car, and I text when I drive. That's the funny thing. It's like when I rent a car, whether it's here or in America, and I'm going home to visit the fam, all right? Of course, I'll be sitting there and I'll be texting while I'm driving. Now, admittedly, probably stopped at a red light or maybe in traffic. I won't text at 60 miles an hour. Probably. But there's the story that we heard, 2 months ago about that poor driver on the F3 who was killed because he pulled over into the breakdown lane to answer the phone. Now, I don't know what the hell that phone call was, but it's a phone call that cost him his life. So there was something so demanding about the call that was being issued by this device. Now that guy, he did the right thing. He pulled over, but then a truck ran into him and killed him. So what's going on here? This is the first question. And really what I want to do is spend the next half an hour period of time answering this question. What is it that's making us so stupid? And of course, it's It's not stupidity. If it were stupidity, stupidity could be cured. And I don't think it's the kind of thing that can be cured. The problem is a lot thornier. It's a lot deeper than that. Now, in order to understand it, I'm going to give you my own point of view about what's going on. And to do that, we're going to have to get in our time machine and go back 35 years. So, this is a multimedia presentation. I'm about to prove it, because I'm about to send you all back to 1975. So, 1975, I'm 12 years old. This is the number one song that I remember. Now, you guys remember it because it got remade a couple of years ago. It's Lady Marmalade. But I remember this as being the number one song on the radio. I remember being absolutely scandalized when one of my friend's moms translated the French for me. All right, voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? And, but I remember this song as just sort of being in the background for 1975. So, when I talk about 1975, if you folks are mostly 1920, 21, it is similar to me having someone talk to me about what life was like during World War II. It's that removed from your own experience. So I won't belabor the point, but I'll say I was a young geek growing up in Rhode Island, suburban Rhode Island, which is this area over by Boston in Massachusetts in North America. And it was an interesting time to be in America because the country had just sort of fallen apart. Richard Nixon had just resigned because of the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford was president. The country was falling apart. Everything felt like it was falling apart, except underneath, in this really, really interesting way, there was this new thing that was being born. So this song was popular through the middle part of 1975. January 1975, popular electronics featured this thing. Now, this is probably the most important, it's certainly the most important issue of popular electronics ever published. It's actually one of the most important copies of any magazine published anywhere ever. Because this little thing here, the Altair 8800 that's showing on the cover, this is the first personal computer. All right, there is no other before it. This is it. And it was a kit that you could build. You could go and buy the parts, and for a couple of $100, you could build your own personal computer. So all of the computers that we have in here, including these, descend from this device. So January 1975, already, what you get is you go from the age where there really are no computers, we'll talk about that in a second, and you now enter the age where computers start to become completely ubiquitous. And later on in that year, these two guys, do you know who these two guys are? You probably know who the guy on the left is. That's Bill Gates. This is Paul Allen. All right? These two guys get together to form a company to write software for the Altair 8800. They form a company known as Microsoft. All right? So literally, the world that you're living in today begins in 1975. Okay, so it is February 1975. This is what Rhode Island looks like in February. I mean, not anymore because of global warming, but when I was growing up, this is certainly how it looked. And I remember getting a call from my friend Bobby. Bobby says, hey, let's go hang out with my dad. My dad's going into work today. Like, it's a Saturday. Why are we going to go hang out with your dad? Oh, come on. It'll be fun. It'll be really fun. We'll go hang out with him. Okay. Well, I didn't actually know what Bobby's dad did. Turns out that Bobby's dad ran a computer data center. Now, you probably never even, maybe, you've probably seen rooms with servers. That's not what a computer data center looked like back then. This is what a computer data center looked like circa 1975, all right, where there's a bunch of technicians sitting in front of these things, and we'll talk about what these things with the keyboards are in a second, and then there's a big mini computer or a mainframe computer back then. And this is, in 1975, this is what all computers looked like. They were this size or they were bigger. All right, and they had operators, and people did things. And so we were going to basically go in while his father ran like backups and whatnot on the computers and just sort of maintained them, and we're going to fart around the office. Well, we get there, and Bobby's dad goes off to this special glass-enclosed room where the computer is, and we can't get into that because it's clean and special and pristine. And instead, we're sort of left out in this lounge area, which is nice because it's carpeted, it's got some nice lighting, and it has these things. Now, how many of you have seen one of these? This is a teletype, all right? Before there were monitors, there were these things, all right? So you have essentially what is an endless stream of paper called green bar, because it's got little green bars across it. and you have a keyboard up there, and you type things, and it prints out, and the computer prints things back, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on, and that's how you interacted with the computer. All right, so that's a teletype. So Bobby sits me down in front of this teletype. I say, okay, now what? He says, oh, well, and he reaches over, and he types that onto the teletype. Now, at this point, all I can really report is that there's a hole in space and time. Now, how many of you are familiar with flow or flow theory or the idea of flow? It's used a bit when you're talking about interaction with computers and computer interface design. You're actually all familiar with it because you've all been there. Think about when you're doing something that you really love, whether that's playing footy or whether that's playing an instrument. It's almost always concerned with the idea of play, but you also might be reading something that you really like, whatever it is. And there's just a period of time where there's no sensation of time because you're just completely involved. That's the flow state. And for instance, computer designers or interaction designers know that they've got something right. A game designer knows that they've got something right when someone can play something and they enter a flow state. All right? The first time that I touched a computer, and I went and searching, and this is basically, this is what, if you can imagine this printed rather than on a screen, this is what I was doing. I was playing a simulator of a Star Trek game where I'd be moving my spaceship around, I'd be killing Klingons, I'd be exploring worlds and whatnot. And I did this for about 4 hours, game after game after game after game. And I just didn't even think about it. It was just playing game after game. And I was in this total flow state. And it's just, you know, there it was. Now, what am I doing during this period of time? I'm exploring the game, right? I'm learning the game, I'm exploring the game, I'm exploring what's possible with this weird thing that I've been sat down in front of that I've had no experience of before. And suddenly, it's 4 hours later. We got there at 9 a.m. It's suddenly 1 p.m. and I'm basically being physically removed from the teletype because I don't want to leave, I don't want to go home. And that was it. I was pretty much done. So I'm 12 years old, and from the first moment that I touched anything that was modestly like a computer, and that was a computer, from that moment forward, I knew exactly what I would be doing with the rest of my life. I would be playing, because I considered this act of interaction with a computer, I'd be playing. And I'd spend my life playing. Now remember, as a 12-year-old, there was no sex in the picture yet, so things are very uncomplicated. In that sense, you can just say, well, yeah, of course this is what I'm going to do, because you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. So you can set your goals very clearly. Of course, as you grow up and become an adult, your goals get muddier. But I had found my North Star, and I'd set my compass to it. Now, what did you do? In 1975, again, you couldn't really, I mean, you could build that model that I showed you in Popular Electronics, but there really weren't personal computers around. So what could you do? Well, I proceeded to go take a computer programming course up at the Community College of Rhode Island, which is basically the equivalent of TAFEs, but in Rhode Island. And it's a building that makes this one look beautiful. All right, I want you to imagine it sort of looks like a nuclear reactor back there that basically captures the spirit of it. It's all concrete and very modernist. And, of course, I'm a 13-year-old taking a course in computer programming, and, of course, I'm the youngest person in the room. There's mostly people in their middle age trying to sort of retrain themselves for a new career. So I take a computer programming course there. And then as soon as they offered computer programming courses at my high school, I was the first person to start taking those. And it was a love affair, and it continued. The more interaction I had with a computer, the more I had that love affair with what was possible with the computer. And of course, it dictated the choice of the university that I went to. I went to MIT because in 1980, when I went to uni, that was the place you went if you wanted to study computer science. There was no other really good. Now there's a whole bunch of places. You could go to Stanford, you could go to MIT, you could go to several other schools, but MIT was really the top of the list back then. Now, after I left MIT, I was working as a computer programmer because, again, it was what I loved to do. So I started to work as a software engineer and was sort of learning how to do that. But I came back to visit some friends who were still at MIT. This was in the summertime, so there were no classes there, but people could still live on campus. And there were all these geeks hanging out there. And that's saying something because MIT is kind of filled with geeks as it is. So there's more geeks than normal. And I asked my friends, well, what's going on? They say, well, it's this thing called the Xanicon. I'm like, well, what's the Xanicon? They say, okay, it's really hard to explain what the Xanicon is. Let me just give you a book that'll tell you about it. And they hand me a copy of this book called Literary Machines. So Literary Machines is a book that's written by this fellow. This is Ted Nelson. Now, have you talked about Ted Nelson at all? Okay. So Ted Nelson, you know, I guess I'm going to have to turn these down because we're just... Okay, that's probably not too bad. It's kind of dark. Ted Nelson coined the word hypertext. So, and he's probably one of the three people who can be credited with inventing hypertext. And he wrote Literary Machines in order to explain what hypertext was to people. And the basic idea that is incorporated in the idea of hypertext is that he said every book that you've ever read, whether you know it or not, implicitly references other books. Because the people who wrote those books are referring to information that they learned from other books. And then those refer to other books. And those books refer to all the way back to the beginning of writing. All writing has implicitly referred to other writing. So all texts, whether you know it or not, are linked together. And what I want to do, he says in Literary Machines, is to build a system that allows us to link everything together, to make all of those implicit links explicit, to be able to explore how knowledge is connected together. And I was completely blown away by this vision, this idea that all the computer could be used to link all of this knowledge together and all of this knowledge in an interesting way. And it was as if, for me, there was an aha moment, because I'd had this enormous love of computers, but I'd never been able to sort of direct it to what computers could do. It was just sort of this generic, wow, I'm really excited by computers. But now I saw, oh, wait, this is the thing that I actually want to do with computers. This is the thing worth doing with computers. And so I finally had a reason behind all of that emotion. So my passion was married to a purpose. And that was sort of the second level of seduction for me with computers. Now, in the 1980s, again, before you were born, hypertext was actually a really, really hot topic. So Apple, for the Macintosh, produced a program called HyperCard. And HyperCard allowed you to have a stack of cards, and you can link places in the cards, and people did big CD-ROMs with lots of linked cards on them. And there was a very famous one by a company called Voyager, which was an exploration of the works of Beethoven, which got rave reviews, and it was going to be the way the future would be revealed. And in fact, HyperCard actually then led to the development of something called Director. You're probably familiar with Adobe Director, which then led to something called Flash, which you're also familiar with. So there's actually a line here between the hypertext work that was being done in the 1980s and what you see on the web today. Now, I was also working on hypertext systems too. In fact, before Apple was doing HyperCard, I was sitting at home programming my own hypertext system for the Macintosh. And the thing that I realized after I got it all up and running was that there wasn't enough information on a single disk drive. Now, a single disk drive back in 1986 when I was doing it was 20 megabytes. All right, that was a single normal disk drive that would be on a computer. And there was no way that you'd have enough information on a single disk drive that even if you linked it all together would actually be interesting. It might be okay, but it wouldn't be exciting. It wouldn't reach the critical mass that you'd need to be able to sort of tip it over into something that everyone would be interested in. Well, that would then soon happen. Okay, so the World Wide Web, which is the universal hypertext system that you're all familiar with. The web and I go way back. Now, most of you have never known a world without the web, except for some of the older students in here. Most of you, by the time you were aware of the fact that there were devices out there and you could play with them, the web was around. The web was on them. Okay. So the web and I go way back. We go back not quite to the beginning, but almost to the beginning. So 1993. In 1993, my new passion for computers, because hypertext hadn't happened the way I thought it was going to happen. I thought it was going to happen in the 80s. It didn't happen the way I thought it was going to happen. I moved on. I started to work in a field called virtual reality. Now, you're all sort of vaguely familiar with what virtual reality is, right? We don't actually wear any of this crazy shit anymore because it's bad for you, as it turns out. This thing called a head-mounted display works the same way that a 3D movie or a 3D television set does. Incredibly bad for you. And Panasonic and Sony and all these companies are trying to sell you 3D TVs right now, and they're trying to say that they're okay. Not true. They're actually probably quite bad for you, and there's probably going to be a massive lawsuit in another year or two, but whatever. So it's fine if you go see a movie once a month for a couple of hours, it's going to be fine to use 3D. If you're using it a couple hours every night, probably not so good for you. And this is one reason why these devices aren't popular now. So I'm doing my research in virtual reality, and I'm going to a big computer graphics conference. And at this computer graphics conference, one of my friends is running this entire section of programs and exhibits around education and things that you can use computers for in education. And so I wander through this section, and I wander over to a computer, and this is what it looks like, more or less, although it's in color. And I grab the mouse, and I go click, click, click. Oh, look, a hypertext system, big deal. Well, as it turns out, that was the first time, July 1993, it was the first time I'd actually clicked anything on the World Wide Web. And I sort of just dismissed it. I was like, oh, look, it's another hypertext system. I've seen hypertext systems for 10 years now, whatever. And the reason I dismissed it is because there wasn't really enough stuff there. You know, just like the problem with having all the stuff on a single disk drive or on a single HyperCard stack. There wasn't really enough stuff there. Now, the story I'm going to tell in this part is how there got to be enough stuff there. And this is important because, again, for those of you who are 20-ish, you'll have never known a time before the web. You'll have never known a time before the web was so big that it simply didn't matter. Well, I'm going to give you an eyewitness report of what it was like as the web came into being, because that story will help you to identify it when it happens again, and it's happening again right now. So, let's flash forward 3 months' time, and I have this nice juicy consulting job at Apple, and this is before Apple was doing anything cool, so don't get excited. And I managed to take some of my money, and I buy myself a workstation. Now, a workstation, we really don't even have workstations anymore because computers are really powerful. But a workstation was just basically a really powerful computer. And I had it because I wanted to do some programming at home on virtual reality stuff. But one of the other things I did was as soon as I got it wired into a modem, you guys probably still remember vaguely what modems are, wired it into a modem, dialed up to the internet, and went and grabbed a web browser so that I could get onto the web. Because in the 3 months between when I played with it at this graphics conference and now, the web had actually grown a bit. And the way I'd known the web had grown was because I got an email from a mailing list that I was on, and I got this weird thing in the email. And I just, like, I looked at it, and that's the actual thing that I got in the email. And when I looked at it, this is sort of what I felt. And what I was looking at was my first URL. And I sort of said, okay, what is this URL thing? Oh, it means it's a thing on the World Wide Web. Oh, I'm going to have to go and get on the World Wide Web. Oh, that means I'm going to have to download this software and install it. And I dutifully installed the software, and I launched it. And I was amazed because in the 3 months that I'd been away, people had been really, really, really busy putting things into the web. And now, most of these people in 1993 were researchers, because the core of the people behind the web were physicists, and then beyond them might have been some computer scientists and so on and so forth. So they put up the kinds of things that they like. And so there were some of the things, so there were all this physics stuff, there's some mathematics stuff, some computer science stuff. There was also, for me, because not only am I a geek, I actually happen to like mysticism and magic, there was the Anders Magic page, which is this page with all these different resources of all this mysticism stuff. And I was really, really, when I found that, that was when the penny dropped for me. I was like, oh, this is really cool. I have all this other stuff that I'm interested in. Let me go research this and follow all these links. And I started then going through the list, and so NCSA kept a list of all the sites that they knew about on the World Wide Web. And so I would go to work, and I'd come home every night and fire up the computer, and I'd dial in, and I'd go surf all these sites, and at the end of the week, I had surfed the entire web. I am not making that up. Because in October 1993, you could surf the entire web. And in fact, as they kept on adding new sites, I would, you know, let's see what the new sites are. I'd log in, surf those. And I could do that through about the middle of November. And then there were just getting to be kind of, by the beginning of December, I just had to go, okay, yeah, you know, I'm not going to be able to surf every site that pops up. I'm just going to follow the sites that are interesting to me. And that list grew too long. You know, you couldn't really look through the list because the list started to have hundreds and then thousands of different sites on it. And so two very clever folks, Jerry Yang and Dave Filo over at Stanford, decided that they were going to take this list and sort it by category. And they called it Dave and Jerry's Master List of the Internet, which today we now call Yahoo. But by December, they were starting to keep this list. And so the web was now starting to really grow. And here's the reason it was really starting to grow. It was growing because everyone saw something on the web that they related to. Everyone saw something on the web that they liked. Everyone saw something on the web that seduced them. And once that act of seduction had happened, you didn't really sort of have to do anything more. It just sort of took care of itself. And I was an agent of that seduction, as were several other people that I know. People who got into the web early didn't shut up about it. Oh my God, it's amazing. And we just blab to our friends, and they'd be like, yeah, yeah, fine, okay, wait. And we'd get them online, they'd be like, oh yeah, right, it's cool. You know. And so I'll give you a specific case in point. In January 1994, and I decide that I'm going to drag my big, heavy Spark station and a 30-kilo monitor, this huge, huge monitor. It literally weighed 30 kilos, a boat anchor. I drag it across town, and I go to this party-slash-performance event called Anon Salon, which happens in San Francisco, which is where I was living at the time. And I get it over there, and I get this really, really long phone cable and, you know, get it to the modem and tie it to wherever the phone jack is on the other side of the place. All right, now the Anon Salon was famed for having a sort of certain intellectual, somewhat geeky, but very, very hip crowd of people who would come along to it. San Francisco, 1994. And so basically what would happen is I have my little Spark station set up with the web browser on it, and people would come in. I knew a fair bit of people who'd come to this party. Someone would pop in. Oh, hey, Eric, how's it going? Hey, how's it going? Hey, what's something you're interested in? Gardening. Oh, wow, that's really cool. And they'd start clicking away. And say, oh, hey, Jane. Hey, what's up? Not too much. What's going on? So, what's something you're interested in? All right, she might go, geology. Okay. Oh, wow, that's really cool. All right. At no point during this process did I say anything about the World Wide Web, or did I say anything about hypertext, or did I say anything about the internet. I simply allowed them to be hooked by their own interest. Because by this point, by January 1994, there was enough there that if you wanted to, once you started to look, you would become hooked because it would represent the things that you were already interested in. And so you'd become seduced by the fact that the web was reflecting you. Now, 2 years later, San Francisco would become the epicenter of the web era, the web 1.0 era, right? It's where all the different web companies would be headquartered. Now, it was because there was myself and a number of other people like myself running around the city at the time, infecting as many people as possible with the bug of the web. So it had longer to germinate there. So people had their penny drop moments. Oh, we should do this. So I remember in June of 1994, visiting a friend who was working at Wired Magazine. He was one of the people who was getting Wired Magazine online. Wired Magazine was the first magazine to go online with a website. And he was moving some computers around. I said, what are you doing? Oh, some of my friends are setting up a little company upstairs. I said, really? What are they going to do? I said, oh, they're going to do web advertising. What do you mean? Well, you know, you can have little advertisements on the web. No, I'm still not getting this. What do you mean? All right, I mean, this is how thick I was. All right. Well, you know, apparently you can have little advertisements and people can put them in web pages. And I was like, people will pay for that? I said, well, yeah, they already have Volvo as a client. I guess people are going to pay for that. And I'm just helping them get set up. So all of these different penny drop moments are happening all around us all the time in Sydney as we're starting to sort of figure, probably in San Francisco, as the web is growing. Now, so as these waves of seduction spread out, because it was so easy not just to view the web, but to create web pages, someone who was seduced by the web would then also be seduced by the idea of being able to share their own experience, share their own knowledge inside of the web. And so that wave of seduction wouldn't just be a one-way street, it would be a multi-way street, because you would provide something, you would show someone something, they would show something back, and it would go on and go on and go on, and it would spread out so that the waves of seduction would spread out. And basically, you can chart it out from early 1994 to around 2000, all right? And in that period of time, that six-year period, the internet, which used to not be the same thing as the web, became entirely identified with the web, so that we think of them as being the same thing. When someone says the internet, they often mean the web. When someone says the web, they often mean the internet. Well, they're two separate things. I mean, the web sits on the internet. But this process of just enveloping the internet became complete because there was these waves and waves and waves of seduction. And as the web grew, as people added more things to it, there were more reasons to come back. There were more reasons to be seduced by it. So it became ever more seductive. And all of this pulled everyone into it. It pulled everyone in our world, anyway, into it. And it became so important that it is basically now impossible for us to imagine a time before the web. It is literally impossible for you to imagine a time before the web because it is outside your scope of experience. You know, if you're 20 or under in this room, 21 or under, it is literally outside the scope of your experience. The only comparison I can make to that is what it would have been like for electrification for our great-great-grandparents. All right, because it is literally outside the scope of our experience for what it would be like to live in a world without electricity. Well, in the same way now, for you, though not for me, it is like that vis-a-vis the web. Now, all of this happened not because someone from on high mandated it, not because a government ordered it. It was not the whim of fashion. All right, none of this was sort of like you woke up one day and read in the Sydney Morning Herald, everyone should get on the web. It wasn't like that. It was a seduction. Everyone fell in love with the web. Now, for all of you, that relationship is so basic, it is so lost sort of in the mists of your childhood that there was no chasm that you crossed. For those of us old folks up here in the front, we can all actually remember that. We can all remember our first encounter with the web and why we kept on coming back for more. But it doesn't matter. It's the same, and it's captured part of your heart. Okay. Now, that whole web thing happens, and the framework of that seduction, again, as I said, is 1994 to 2000. And you probably know that there was this web bubble that burst in 2000, 2001. You may have heard of it. There was the great web crash. And that was sort of, there was so much hype, excitement, hysteria, seduction that was taking place that people went crazy for a while, literally crazy for a while. And it all collapsed 2000 to 2001. Now, in the midst of this, when all of this is happening, and I contributed my part because one of the reasons that I'm, I guess, well-known as a person is because one of the things that I did was invent a 3D interface for the World Wide Web. I took my work that I was doing in virtual reality and applied it to the World Wide Web. And so technologies like Second Life, which you're probably familiar with, are basically the descendants of the work that I was doing back in 1993 and 1994. And that work, again, was very popular for a little while. And in the midst of that, when I was very well known for that work, I was invited out to Sydney to give a talk at a conference called Internet World, because that's when the internet was so special that we had conferences dedicated to it. No, seriously. And so I'm flown. This is my first trip to Australia. Flown 14 hours from Los Angeles to Australia. And, of course, because they don't know any better, they put me up in Darling Harbour, the nicest part of Sydney. Now, I didn't know any better either. And I actually knew a couple of folks in Sydney. And so we arrange that we're going to get together and go out, drink and dance one evening. And so I go over and I meet them at the prearranged time in Darling Harbour. And the good friend that I know is there, but this, we're actually like a party of 10 people. And some of us aren't here, and we wait around a little while, and they still aren't coming. And, you know, what the fuck are we going to do? You know, do we stay here and wait for them? Do we go on and hope that they find us? And, you know, it's a very hard choice. It's the kind of choice that you don't really want to have to make when you're just planning a nice night out, and you're sort of worried about whether your friends are going to catch up with you. And we're sort of stuck in this bad situation until someone actually pulls out a mobile and makes a call and reaches these people, and we arrange a new place and time, and suddenly there's no dilemma here. Now, you're probably wondering, well, why didn't you think of that up front? Well, let me tell you a story about my homeland. All right, the United States, which is where I grew up, as you can probably tell from my outrageous accent, the United States has the very best wired infrastructure in the world. And for that reason, wireless telephony was very, very slow to take off in the United States of America. So when I land in Australia in 1997, I don't think about the mobile phone as a device. It just sort of hasn't entered my thinking. It hasn't entered my ontology. In other words, you think differently, and we'll come to this in a little bit, when you have a mobile phone in your hand, because it makes you realize that you have different options. And in 1997, in Australia was different, because 1997 was the point where the mobile reached 50% penetration in Australia, which is far earlier than it did in America, which is around 2000, 2001. All right, which meant that in Australia, you or the person next to you had a mobile. And that means that you could be reached and the problem could be solved. And so 1997, at Darling Harbour, as we're trying to sort of sort this thing out with our friends who are missing, is when I have my first sort of, you know, penny drop moment about what's possible there. It had never even occurred to me. Because, trust me, before this in human history, if you arranged to meet your friends at a certain time and place and they weren't there, you were screwed. There was just nothing you could do about it. I mean, because they were either in transit or whatever, you weren't near a phone, it didn't matter. You know, there it was. Now, that's what the mobile meant in Australia in that example. Now, I went back to America, I still did not buy a mobile, until at that time I was teaching at the USC Cinema School in Los Angeles. And the dean of the cinema school tried to reach me one day. And wherever I was, I wasn't near my home phone, I wasn't near my office phone, whatever, I was out. And the next morning, I am called onto the carpet in the dean's office. We couldn't reach you. Like, yeah, sorry, back now. Well, I'm giving you an option. You can either get a pager or you can get a mobile. And that was when I got my first mobile. Now, I was still just a little bit earlier than most Americans, but most Americans were starting to get mobiles then. Now, a mobile means, of course, that no one's out of reach. It also means that no one is late anymore. You don't live in a world where people are late. You live in a world where people are delayed. You only have cause to be upset with your friends if they forget to text you or they neglect to text you. All right? That's the act of unfriendliness. It's that they're refusing to connect, or if they're trapped in a tunnel, I suppose. There are some places where you don't get signals. Before I moved to Sydney, I lived in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles, which is this beautiful canyon that's just outside the city center. And I lived down at the bottom of the canyon. This is 2003. And friends would come up to my house, and they would realize they had no mobile coverage, which is true, because I lived in the bottom of a canyon. And they would freak out and demand to use my phone so they could call their friends and tell them that they couldn't reach them. True story. All right. So the device had become such an important part of life. Now, the thing is that here, Australia, America, okay, what do? They smooth things, you know. They make them easier. They're nice. No one's saying that the mobile's not nice. But how essential are they? Now, that story is very different in other parts of the world. So, let me tell you a couple of stories. First, the Kerala coast in India. Fishermen have been fishing off the Kerala coast for a couple thousand years. And there's always been a bit of a problem because the fishermen have a choice of ports that they can pull into and sell their catch on any given day. So on some days, too many fishermen will pull into one port and the fishermen can't sell their fish at the right price. And meanwhile, there's another port a couple of k's up the coast and no one has pulled into it, and so there's no fish available at any price. Well, in 1997-1998, India deregulated its telecoms industry, and mobile phone towers started going up everywhere around India. And if you put them on the coastline, it turns out that you can actually get a signal about 20 k's out. And at some point, some relatively rich fishermen brought a mobile out to sea. Who knows why? But at some point, they called into shore and realized that if they went to this particular port, there was no one else there, and they'd be able to sell their fish at a nice high price that day. And so they did that. And then the next day, when the fishermen went out, they called in to find out who needed fish. And that story then passed around to the other fishermen, so that within a few months' time, all of the fishermen on all of the boats in Kerala had mobiles, and they were all calling in to shore to find out who needed fish that day. And so, within about a year's time, all of the fishermen were making enough money from the sale of their fish, because they were now getting the fish to the markets where they needed it, that a mobile phone, which basically cost them 2 months' income at that time, 2000, phones were still relatively expensive, would be paid for in 1 month from the extra earnings. And this is also happening now, say, in Nigeria, where farmers are using mobile phones to call ahead to markets to figure out which market is going to offer them the best price for their produce on a given day, and they will take the produce to that market. Or, if you're a barber in Pakistan, rather than renting out a shop and expecting your traffic to come to you, what you do is you buy a mobile, you print up posters with the number on it, you have your clients call you, pick a time that's convenient to them, you drive over on your little motor scooter, give them a nice shave, and go on. Much lower costs. Or, again, this is Kenya. They have a system called M-Pesa, which is basically a mobile banking system, so you can move money through the banking system. All right? So I can send you money by sending you a text message, literally. Now, the interesting thing about this is that in order for people work in the cities in Kenya, but people need money out in the hinterlands in Kenya. And so people would spend a day a week traveling back and forth between the city and the hinterland to be able to physically deliver money to someone who needed it, whether it was mom or the wife or whatever. They would literally have to physically transport the money because it was the only trustworthy way of being able to do that. Well, they don't need to do that anymore. All you need is two mobiles and an M-Pesa account. And now all of a sudden, everyone's getting all the money they need all of the time without having to spend all of that time doing it. And, hold on just 1 second, because there's a slide out of order here. Slide very out of order here. Nope, just a little bit out of order. There we go. And, in most of the developing world, mobile minutes are now an unofficial form of currency. So you can actually, if you owe someone a debt or want to do some sort of monetary exchange, you can give them minutes. You can give them 20 minutes on a mobile, or you can give them a certain amount of money. So mobile time has become interchangeable with money through most of the developing world. Now, economists have been going bananas studying all of the phenomena that I've pointed out to you. One of the things that they know already is that at a baseline, when you give an individual a mobile, or they buy it, whatever, when they have a mobile, you have increased their effectiveness, which translates into an increased ability to be able to earn money. There is a direct correlation between the growth in GDP in a country and the percentage of that country which owns mobiles. All right, direct correlation. So the larger the population who owns mobiles, the higher the growth in GDP. Mobiles equal success, equal wealth. It is absolutely proven. It's that simple, and of course, the more we look, the more examples we find. And when you have that kind of relationship with the mobile, you know, what do you do with this goose that keeps on delivering you golden eggs? Well, what do? You fall in love with it. So, we've all now, we've all been seduced. Now, the funny thing is, this chart was done in, I think, 2005. And it shows that the number of mobile subscribers in the world was predicted to be 4 billion in 2010. That chart is wrong. The number of mobile subscribers by the end of 2010 will be 5 billion. All right? That is everyone over 12 who earns more than $2 a day. That's everybody. All right? Mobile subscription rate in Australia is 104%. Which means that there are aliens. No. It means that people have more than one mobile subscription here. But what it means in general is that everyone's getting mobiles. Now, non-governmental organizations are very clear on all of the statistics that I just quoted at you. And they know all of this arithmetic. And so they're working very, very, very hard to get mobiles into the hands of that lowest quartile who don't have them already. And so by 2015, probably 6 of the 7 billion people on planet Earth, which is basically probably everyone that can handle it, will be connected constantly. And that's amazing in itself, and that would be completely amazing if that was where it ended. But we haven't stopped moving. And neither have our devices. And the more we use them, the more we use these devices, the more we understand what we can use them for. So in 1997, in Australia, the mobile was used for voice calls. People were not sending text messages in 1997. They were using the mobile for voice calls. Texting hadn't taken off. Texting took off, what, around 2000-ish? First in Europe and then around the world. And of course, now we send many more texts than we do minutes of phone calls, at least here. America's a different story, but at least here. And the reason for this is essential, and it's something that you need to absorb as one of the lessons of this talk. We need to play. Specifically, we need to have a play with an object, with a technology, before we really understand what it's good for. And I don't mean you have a play for a minute. I don't mean you have a play for an hour, or for a day, or for a week, or for a month. I mean you have a play for years and years and years. I want to give you two really good examples of this. All right. Wikipedia. The technology behind Wikipedia was invented in 1995. The wiki. We could have had Wikipedia in 1995. Absolutely could have. We didn't get Wikipedia until 2001. Why? Because there were 6 years of sitting and having a good think about what you could do with things. And even then, it took a couple of years for Wikipedia to grow enough until people were actually seduced by it. I mean, the same process of seduction that happened for the web happened for Wikipedia. It's the same thing over and over again. All right? But just because you have a capability doesn't mean that you have the behavior that's associated with the capability. Now this thing, you're going to hear shitloads about this thing. Of course, this is an iPad, right? And a lot of the technology pundits have been saying, well, you know, it's really good for consuming media, but it's not really good for creating media. Now, when I hear people say this, I think about the web in 1995. Oh, it's really good for publishing stuff, but people won't be able to, you know, do stuff. Basically, what they're saying is that this is done, that it won't have any time to evolve, that once people play with it, it's just going to remain the same thing, that we won't see depths in it, that we won't explore it, that it won't open up to us. All right? So when people say that this is a platform, it's a good platform for consuming media. I've heard lots of people say that. But I think that next year, and then 5 years from now, it's going to be this window into this completely creative universe. And so think about that. So it takes time to play with something to know what it's good for. Now, something like that is going on with the mobile right now. And this is the current hot mobile, which Kate has, actually. She'll probably show you after the talk if you want. I think this is the HTC Desire, but it's the same thing as her Nexus One, which is her mobile. Okay. So you have something that's developing on two fronts simultaneously. You have the technical advance of the device. All right, so this is a 3GS, an Apple 3GS iPhone. This is pretty whiz-bangy. Hers is slightly more whiz-bangy. Okay, this thing is about 1,000 times faster and probably about 10,000 times more storage than that picture of the computer from 1975 that I showed you, in rough terms. Okay, and yet here it is. It's not taking a room. I don't have to have separate terminals running into it. Now, so, and this is not slowing down. So this thing is continuously becoming technically more capable. And as it becomes technically more capable, more horizons for possibility open up inside of it. So that's one half of what's going on here. But the other half of what's going on here is the development of human behaviors. Oh, come on, it's Photoshop. The development of human behaviors that are associated with the device. Okay? Because, again, what happened in Kerala? What happened in Nigeria? What happened in Pakistan? What happened in Kenya? Those aren't technologies. Those are human behaviors. Now, the interesting thing about what happens with a human behavior is when a human behavior is introduced to a network, and we're all networked together now, all 5 billion of us, it uses the network to spread. It's not reliant on me telling you. All you have to do is watch someone else do it over the network. You pick up the behavior, it gets carried on. So these new behaviors spread incredibly quickly these days. This is actually much more true in the developing world than it is in the developed world, again, because they have much more reliance on these technologies. So a new crack for a mobile phone that gets developed in Ghana is showing up in Kenya 2 days later because the networks spreads these things. And every time the technology gets better, and every time a new behavior gets introduced and spread through the network, the device, the relationship to the device, becomes more alluring. So we have this situation where the entire world has tipped over into falling in love with the device, and the relationship with the device is growing stronger and stronger and stronger. Think about it. I mean, just the iPhone is a really good example of this. When the iPhone was introduced, the first version, which wasn't even sold here, there were about, I guess, what, 7, 8 apps for it that Apple had? All right? And now there's several hundred thousand, I think is the current number. There's a few hundred thousand apps. And these apps are kind of like websites. There's an app for everyone with their specific thing that they love. And every time you find a new app you love, it makes you closer to the device. And it's been going on like this for at full steam, at full tilt, this relationship between ourselves and these devices, this seduction has been going on at full tilt for a decade. And so these devices are becoming very alluring indeed. So, got to tell you, I started working on the New Inventors back in 2005. And James O'Loughlin, the host of the show, used to make fun of me because they called me a futurist. Now, I never called myself a futurist, but they called me a futurist on the tagline. He's like, Mark, you know, he'd make fun of me when we're getting out on the set, warming up the audience. That's a futurist. I don't know, James. He said, well, he turned to me one day and says, well, you're a futurist. Make us a prediction. There's a big audience here. I'm like, great, I'm a fucking psychic, James, thanks. I didn't say that. It's a family show. But I'm like, all right. You want a prediction? I'll give you a prediction. In 5 years' time, you'll all be using your mobiles 10 times more. And you can sort of hear a groan, a bit of a gasp come out of the audience. Because in their hearts, they knew it was true. And true enough, look at how we're using a mobile in 2005, and you look at how you're using a mobile in 2010. Now, let me ask, do a sort of sample poll. I'm going to ask you folks what age you were when you got a mobile. Okay. 13? Okay. 15? 20? Okay, all right, so there's a distribution, but I think the distribution is like 15-ish. So, and that would be, you know, 5 years ago-ish, so 2005 sort of thing. Okay. It's 5 years later, and we're using our phones 10 times more. And the interesting thing is, of course, we aren't talking on them much more. Talk time has remained just about the same. Texting continues to climb, all right? But it's climbing at pretty much a steady rate. But that's not what's going on with the device in our hands. That's the interesting thing. The device is becoming more flexible, so we're spending more time interacting with it because we're doing more things with it. And I don't know if you've noticed, I have, because I've been watching, but the default social posture in public now that someone assumes, on the bus, on the train, wherever, is into the device. And it's because what we see there is alluring. It's because what we see there is our connections with everyone else, the things that make us happy, our hobbies, whatever they might be, but they're all coming into this device, and they're coming into this device as a nexus. And so this device becomes more and more alluring as we become more connected to it. It reshapes our behaviors. And now we've come full circle. And we've come back to Mother Modernhood. And so the mobile has effectively inserted itself into our ontology, into the way we be, into the way we think. It's inserted itself both as an idea and as an object. And every day, there are now more and more reasons to spend more time with it because it makes us more effective, because it entertains us better, all these different things, because it connects us better. We have a relationship with it, and we're having more and more reasons to love it. There's that lovely Simpsons episode where, you know, Homer calls the television his secret lover. Right? You all know that line. And really, that's the relationship we have with our mobile phones. And there's no breaking away from this relationship. We are way, way, way too far down the tunnel. So there's this term in astrophysics, the Schwarzschild radius. Schwarzschild radius is a sort of hypothetical line that's around a black hole. When you're on the right side of the Schwarzschild radius, you can get back out again. You're on the wrong side. No matter what you do, no matter how fast you go, including the speed of light, you will never escape the Schwarzschild radius. You'll never escape the black hole. And that's where we are in this relationship. We are so far down the tunnel that really what we are looking forward to and where we're heading toward is a point of time where we're spending all of our time staring at the device. And you have this image. Someone told me about this classic image that they saw in Washington, D.C., with two people sitting next to each other on a park bench, hunched over their BlackBerries, occasionally looking up to one another and saying, I'm listening. And you've all done that with your friends. You've all done that as you divide your attention between the device and what's going on in the real world. And that's not the future. That's the present. That's where we are right this minute. I want you to think about that. I want you to, when you leave the building today, I want you to tear yourself away. I want you to have a good look around just for a minute, and you will see the truth of it. Now, that's the talk. That's the talk. What I want to do is spend a little time letting you talk. Because I don't really, I know what I've said is true, but the thing is that you're living in it from a different perspective than where I'm living in it. And I don't necessarily think that what I've said is bad. I don't even necessarily think that it's scary, because we're exchanging one kind of awareness for another, but we are definitely exchanging one kind of awareness for another. It's somewhat less immediate, it's a more diffuse awareness, it's a more broadly connected awareness, and this is the thing that I want to talk about. So, if you are, and you people like to call you the native tribe, they like to say that we're the digital immigrants and you're the digital natives, in this case even more so, because you know, if you've had a mobile since you were 12 years old, or even 15, or in your case 20, how old are you? 21, so you've only had a mobile for a year. Oh, 31. Okay, yeah, okay, so you've had a mobile for a long time. All right, yeah, yeah. So that, no, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, if you've all had mobiles for several years, so you're all sort of in the tube together with us. So, I'm trying to figure out how to ask the question, because I'm not really sure. What I want to ask you is, what does it feel like? What does it feel like to be as constantly connected as you are now? But it's sort of like I'm trying to ask you, as if you were a fish, asking you what the water is like. All right. How about I put it this way? How many of you spend a lot of time in a place where there's no connectivity at all? What does that feel like?
Different.
Huh? Does it feel good?
Yeah.
So you look forward to it. How do your friends feel about it? All right, yes.
It's like there's too much demand and less as an excuse, like you said, about being in a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to come up with some crazy excuse why you're not connected now.
Right, okay, and this is the thing, you know, is that this is a complete inversion from life as I grew up as a child, right, where the disconnected state was the normal state, and now the hyperconnected state is the normal state. And we haven't, I think, figured out how to balance that. And there are some people now on the internet who are very publicly disconnecting. You know, I'm going off the web, or I'm doing whatever, okay? And they're making very public statements about it. And the question is, because there's a price you pay either way. There's a price you pay for being connected, and there's a price you pay for being disconnected. Do any of you actually seek out? This is a really good question to ask. Do any of you seek out that disconnected space? So, okay, yes, you do. Then how do you do it? Right. Okay, but that's so you're still somewhat connected. Okay. Right. I mean, it's interesting because Kathy and I and Kirk have a friend like this, who in fact actually is a lecturer in this program, who resists being connected and is doing a very good job of it.
Isn't it frustrating though? Because I have friends like that. I'm like that. But then when I try and call my friends, they don't pick up their phones. I'm like, why do you even have one?
I've learned how to work with it. That's the thing. You know, I know how many texts it will take to get him to respond. You know,
Voice calls do work usually.
Exactly. Voice calls do usually work. Exactly. It's things like that. So yeah, you figure out the strategies. You figure out how to be able to connect with them when they won't connect. So do you have something to say about this?
When I'm writing a paper, for example, I'll switch off everything
mm-hmm.
and just go to the library and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and really pick up the phone there.
Right. The library is a disconnected space, isn't it? Except it's crowded with Wi-Fi, is it not? So you can IM or do anything you can do all, so you can remain very connected in the library, you just wouldn't be connected via your mobile.
Well, there's this program called Self-Control, and it can stop you from accessing...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So. It's not really self-control, though, is it? Are you trying to force us out of here?
No, I kind of lost my keys around there.
Oh, no, feel free. Feel free, we're just having a discussion. Okay, but I mean, you are turning on self-control, but that's. But I always laugh about the sort of that you know, you could just turn off the Wi-Fi on your computer, right? Okay, but so other people, I mean, do you even conceive of being disconnected? Yes.
It's like when you don't want to be disconnected. I'm like, if I'm going away to my country, like out of the country, I'm like, oh no, I'm not going to have reception. I'm not going to be able.
Yeah.
Once I'm there, once I've got it, I'm like, thank God I don't have. Like, it's so nice to be in a world where you can't be connected.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, I'm going to be going back to that. It's like it's a constant. It's always going to be there, even if you try and. Don't stay, you're like, try and disconnect yourself, or it's like, all right, I'm going to the middle of nowhere, can't be connected. Eventually, it's like, you're going to come back.
Yes.
You can't escape from.
Yes. And everything has accreted while you've been away. That's the problem. You go away from. For me, it's very much the case with email that if I don't pay a lot of attention to the email, it builds up unbelievably. And, I mean, not so much text messages, but email for me, if I don't pay attention to it, built up unbelievably. So there's always a price that you pay for being disconnected. Anyone else? Stories about connection or disconnection?
Well, I've had the opposite experience, where I didn't have a phone for like 2 months or something. Mm-hmm. And then I bought one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an incredible experience. It was even, like, even though it was only 2 or 3 months without a phone, just there was something about the device where it was, like, this really precious and
mm-hmm.
thing that I could put in my pocket where all my friends were suddenly in.
Exactly, exactly.
And that was a really amazing feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is the thing. That's exactly the thing that I was really trying to talk about over the course of these different seductions. It's that seduction that happens to an individual. I mean, when you get your phone as a 12-year-old, it's going to have. And I presume your parents got it so you could sort of they could sort of keep track of you, right? Here's an interesting thing. And I was talking to Genevieve Bell, is the anthropologist for Intel Corporation. So she's sort of, you know, if I'd grown up differently, and had a sex change, that's who I'd be. She gave a talk at the National Library on last Friday, and I was there. And she said she was doing a study in Korea. And Koreans have mobile phones that they sell for the kids that have GPS tracking in them so that the parents can always know where the kids are. And Genevieve hears about this story and immediately just gets all very Orwellian and creepy and asks the kids how they feel about it. And the first thing they say is, oh, well, you see our friend over there? Her parents don't love her enough to give her one of these phones. So it was a complete inversion of what she was expecting. That, in fact, that degree of connectivity carried a degree of care with it. All right? Which presumably is how you thought of it when your parents gave you the phone. I mean, it was to keep track of you, but there was a degree of care associated with it. And so what we would see, and I think it's a temporary effect of the Orwellian thing, all kids... probably from, and I mean, the numbers I've been hearing out of teachers in Victoria now is that really from grade 3 on is when you start seeing kids getting mobile, so from age 9, more or less, is when you start seeing them. And I think as the phone becomes more of a tracking device, they're going to go down to probably, I guess grade 1 is going to be reasonable, maybe even kindy. All right, the kindy phone is only going to have a button to call mom. Because they already sell phones like this. That's the thing. So they basically have a phone that has GPS trackers, Disney characters, and it calls mom and dad. But you're basically just going to get that, and that's going to be the device, and that will be your entree to connection. We're not quite there yet. So that's why I wanted to say you should have a look around, because we're in the middle of this change. So the change that you missed with the web, the change that you missed with computing, both changes that I got to see because I was in the right time at the right place, we're in the middle of for mobiles right now. You are in the middle of it. And what you can do, because what I do is you can just look at your own behavior and the behavior of your friends, and you can see what's going to happen to the whole culture as a result of that. Because what's happening to you and your friends is being replicated over and over everywhere, not just in Australia, but in America and in Africa and everywhere else. All right. Do you think that's enough? Is it 1:30? That's 1:20. I could go 10 more minutes if you want. Thoughts?
Question?
No. Yes?
I think we're just going to microchip the kids. We've already done it with the cats and dogs.
So,
the little kids that can't have phones, it's just much easier to microchip.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's only RFID, so it's not GPS.
Oh,
Now, I mean, so...
You're not using the iKid.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. I gave an earlier version of this talk about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And someone came up to me afterward and she said, I can't wait to get implants, so I don't have to carry all this. So it's just with me all the time. And I'm just like, I know. There was a science fiction convention. What do you want? They were thinking like this. And actually, because I've got the perfect slide for that. There we go. So, yes. Yeah, so you can reprogram the pacemaker and have fun. Yeah. Well, rather than having to carry around your pass card, right? If you were chipped, you could just wave your arm. How many of you have tattoos? All right, because again, it's completely identifiable. That was one of the reasons why I haven't gotten a tattoo. Because one of my friends said to me, "You know, it shows up on a police report." So. I'm just saying. You know, so I mean, it's as identifiable as a tattoo is. That's the thing about if you get your chipped. All right, so, but I want to come back to this. So I had this conversation.
People can't remotely access you.
They can't remotely access you if you're chipped. So, this woman came up and says, I can't wait to get implants. And I just looked at her and said, you carry your mobile around with you all of your waking hours. Why do you need an implant? You know, I mean, is there what convenience are you gaining if you've implanted it? I mean, maybe some, but
I don't lose it. Like, I've gone through lots and lots of seconds, and then you spend weeks and weeks
I guess there's the Yeah, it's true. If you brick your chip. Firmware upgrade didn't go well. She's in surgery now. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, people are sort of fantasizing about this borged up future. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to take a look at the world of 2010. We are pretty borged up as it is.
Even though I think the phones are